All right, well, we're back on our Heidelberg Catechism study this week. If you need a book, could you raise your hand? And Quentin will be happy to get you a book this week. So just raise your hand if you need a Heidelberg Catechism book. And just be sure to return that to the front pew when you're finished. We are on Lord's Day 34. We started this set of questions briefly last week, so we're actually breaking into the middle of it. We're going to be looking at questions 94 and 95. And that starts on page 92 of the books. But Lord's Day 34, questions 94 and 95. And if you were here last time, you know that we've started looking at the Ten Commandments. We looked at the Ten as a whole last time. And so we're going to start now looking at each commandment one at a time. We're going to take the next 10 lessons or so to go over the Ten Commandments. It takes some time on each one. So the question then is, kids, what is the first commandment? Ian. You shall have no other gods before me. That's right. And that's what we're going to be looking at today. I would guess, though, as we think about this idea of having other gods, I would guess that there would be a number of you who could say that you have never literally bowed down to an idol or to another, prayed to another god besides the true God, or worshipped in another temple or something like that. That's certainly been my experience. I don't have any experience of worshipping another god, specifically in the sense that we think of that. But I guess I'm curious, have any of you seen someone worship in that sense of worshipping another god? Have you been with someone who has bowed down literally to an idol, prayed to another god, and what have you seen like that in your lives? Yeah, well, then that's a great example of something we're seeing more happening in with sort of that spiritual void in our country right now, in a secular, so-called secular country, that you fill that void with something, and you start praying to something. And yeah, so an experience, a very direct experience of Hindu of idolatry, the offerings being made, and like you said, a dedication that puts us to shame sometimes, real committed to that. But those are the kinds of things maybe that we think of when you think of having a god besides our God, right? You think of someone with an altar to somebody else, or with an actual little shrine, or praying to something or someone. Like I said, we're seeing more literal paganism going on in the country around us it's filling that void of spirituality in our country. I think I mentioned recently that I think that the Norse gods are worshiping Thor is now a recognized religion in the Navy, that there's a significant number of Navy personnel who are worshiping, not significant, enough that they could request this official status as a recognized practiced religion in the armed forces. So there's more of this kind of paganism we're talking about rising up, but just because we don't see that on a huge scale around us, as you do in some other countries, doesn't mean that there isn't idolatry going on. Doesn't mean that there isn't idolatry and worship of things that are not God going on all around us. And so hopefully, as we look at these questions here, I hope you'll see that what we're looking at here in the First Commandment applies to that sort of explicit idolatry that we're talking about. But it also applies to many other forms of idolatry that we're guilty of in our own lives and that we see prevalent all around us. And so I hope to help us all become more aware of idols in our own lives, and then also see more clearly what other people worship in their lives, so that you can reach out more effectively to them in turning away from those idols. So question 94 says, what does God require in the first commandment? Answer, that on peril of my soul's salvation, I avoid and flee all idolatry, sorcery, enchantments, invocation of saints or of other creatures, and that I rightly acknowledge the only true God, trust in him alone, with all humility and patience expect all good from him only, and love, fear, and honor him with my whole heart, so as rather to renounce all creatures than to do the least thing against his will. So I won't repeat that this time. That's a long answer, and there's a lot packed into that one answer. But we're going to look here a little bit. This answer basically telling us what it means to have a God. What it means to have a God in your life. And what it means to have the true God as your God. or to have something else in your life as your God, or treat something else as if it is a God. And so think for a moment as we look at you can see some of it here in this answer, but think about, you know, what does it mean to have a God? What do you do to your, or with your God or for your God? What do you expect or want from God? What is it that, what is the relationship of a God and the person worshiping the God? And so I want to start sort of in the middle of the answer here and then come back to the specifics at the beginning. But you see in the very middle, it talks about rightly acknowledging the only true God. That's part of what it means to have God as our God, is to rightly acknowledge that he is the true God. And so John 17, verse 3 is in your book there. I think it's footnote number 4. It says, "And this is eternal life, that they may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." And so for something to be a God in your life, you have to acknowledge that it exists. You have to acknowledge its importance, acknowledge its nature. And so when we worship the true God, we have to acknowledge who he is. It's affirming, and especially in our faith, publicly affirming that this God exists and that this God is who he says he is. And that's one aspect of what it means to have a God. And it's one aspect of us having the true God, is that we acknowledge that he is the true and living God, that he's the greatest and most important. He is the greatest, and he is the most important over all of creation. You see that the scriptures talk about false gods in a couple of different ways. And one of the ways it talks about it says they aren't gods at all. The God is the only true God. He's the only living God. The other gods are nothing. And Acts 19:26 says, "And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods." And that was part of Paul's message, right? These statues that you're worshiping, or this, you know, the forces of nature that you're worshiping, those things are not truly gods. God says that same thing in Isaiah 45, verse 5. "I am the Lord, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God." So that's something we affirm, is that even as we talk about these other gods, we recognize none of them are truly gods. It's not as if there are competing gods and God just happens to be the strongest one. That part of acknowledging God is saying he is the God. He is the one and only true God. But at the same time, the Bible does talk about false gods as, it refers to them as refers to idol worship as demon worship. 1 Corinthians 10:19-20 says, "What do I imply then, that food offered to idols is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, I imply that what pagans sacrifice they offer to demons and not to God." And so even as we say that idols are nothing, when we tell someone to turn from idol worship, from a Hindu shrine and they're offering things, we're not just modernists saying that's just a bunch of hogwash and you should just recognize that it's just a piece of metal or it's just a piece of wood. We do recognize that there could be a spiritual aspect of what's going on. There is a spiritual aspect of what's going on. There may be real spiritual power even going on in their lives as a result of this idol worship, but that it's through demonic forces. And so we're not just saying, on the one hand, we say there are no other gods besides God, but we also say there are real spiritual forces out there that are in opposition to God, and idol worship is often tied up in that, and there is real spiritual power there in some of those religions and that power is from demons. So part of having God as our God is acknowledging that he is the only true God. But it's not just acknowledging. Then the catechism goes on to say that we trust in him. That we trust in him. And we acknowledge a God, but to acknowledge the God that you worship, it doesn't mean much if you just say, yes, he's out there. I believe that this God exists. We also trust in that God. And think about how that's true of all religions, that when someone worships something, they're putting some kind of trust in that God, right? They're trusting that God to do something for them. We do this. We say we trust in God. Psalm 56, verse 4. Psalm 56 has that refrain, "In God whose word I praise, in God I trust, I shall not be afraid. What can flesh do to me?" And so in our human experience, we know how weak we are. We know how many things in our lives are outside of our control. You know, it could be car accidents, it could be disease, it could be weather, it could be government forces, all kinds of things that are so much bigger than us. And we need something to trust. And we turn somewhere. All of us, whether you have a God, you say you have a God or not, every person trusts in something to protect them from these things that are outside of our control. And so that's, I hope you're starting to see that you don't have to have a God that you call a God to be worshiping something, to have something as a God. That you have something, even people who don't say they worship a God, have something they trust to protect them from disaster, from things that we can't control. So there's that element of trust in here. But then also the Catechism goes on and says that we expect all good from Him only. We expect all good from Him only. And if you look, if you turn the page, and if you have the same book here, to James 1:17, it's at the top of the next page. James 1:17 says, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." And so the question is, when you think about needing something good in your life, when you need to think about needing help, needing protection, needing more of something, is God the source of all the good things in your life? Or are there other things you turn to as well? Do you kind of cover your bases in terms of luck or karma, or maybe you expect good things from God, but also you kind of expect that really you're counting on some people in your life, that they're the ones who are going to give you the good things you need. The Catechism says, well, true faith in God is to trust Him for all things, and keeping the first commandment is to trust Him for all the good things in your life. And it is so tempting to turn to other things, because God asks us to be patient sometimes. I really appreciate that this catechism points this out. If you look at it, it says, "With all humility and patience, expect all good from Him only." And I think so often as Christians, the times we fall into idolatry is when we don't want to wait for God. We don't trust His providence. And we say, you think of Abraham, and he didn't want to wait for God to give him a miraculous child, so he went ahead and he found his own way to have a child with Hagar. We do that in our own lives when we don't want to wait for God's gift. And we're willing to break God's law to get what we want. We're willing to trust in something else, willing to compromise our ethics, to compromise God's law to get what we want. And that's a hard place to be. It does take great patience and humility to say, I really want this. I feel I really need this. I have prayed to God for it, and He hasn't given it to me, but I'm still going to wait for Him. And that's keeping the first commandment. But you see how easy it is to break the first commandment there, to take things into our own hands or go a different direction. But we as Christians should expect all good from Him and not be looking to anything else, even though God uses other ways to give us the good things that we should have. And then the Catechism goes on to say we should love, fear, and honor Him. And this gets at the idea that when you worship something, there is an aspect of devotion and love for that thing that you worship. I think so often we think of paganism and think of people putting offerings out for a god or putting something on an altar, and we think of it mostly in terms of that sort of transactional, manipulative way of acting, where you're trying to get something out of the god, and so you have to appease the god with this or that, and that it's purely selfishly motivated, trying to get something out of the god. But if we won't be able to reach out to people tied up in those things if we think that's all it is, because there's an aspect of love and devotion to whatever you worship. It's not just trying to get something out of the god. We are designed to love and serve God. And we're going to fill that void with something. You're going to love and serve and be devoted to something in your life. And either it's the true God or it's something else. And so as you interact with people who are tied up in other forms of idolatry, it may not just be selfish motives in the sense of trying to get something out of that God. We all have that innate desire to serve and worship something and to be devoted to something and love and fear something. And so we have to watch that we aren't more devoted to anything in our lives than we are to God himself. That those good things that he's given us to love and to be devoted to don't take precedence over him. Romans 1 talks about that idea of exchanging the worship of God for worshiping something else creaturely. But it's an exchange, right? We have to worship something. And we will worship something. And so we either worship the true God or we exchange that and worship something else and are devoted to it. And so that's part of keeping the first commandment, is to truly love and fear and honor God with our whole hearts. So that's sort of the overall picture of what it means to have a God. You acknowledge the existence of what you worship. You trust in it. You expect good things from it. And you love, fear, and honor it. And in our case, we're commanded, all people are commanded to love and serve God, to trust in him. And so then the answer here gives a couple of specifics that are mentioned. And I think these are some of them were particularly important at the time when this was written, but they're still applicable today of examples of this kind of idolatry. There at the beginning it talks about all idolatry, literal worship of idols, sorcery, enchantments, invocation of saints, or of other creatures. Can anyone tell us what... Well, we could get to that in just a moment. So sorcery and enchantments are something where, again, we're seeing more of going on in our culture around us. Why do people do magic? Why do people do sorcery and enchantments? What's the goal there usually? What do you say? Trickery, okay. And what are they trying to accomplish with that trickery? Okay. So there's some trickery involved in a lot of the witchcraft. There's a lot of believing in something that's not actually happening there. Robert?
Control.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I had a teenage stepbrother.
So control or power there. There's a power over someone. And like you said, she was trying to get something that she wanted, right? She was trying to get something that she didn't have. And so think about how that fits with this idea of idolatry. You're trying to get some good in a way that's not from God. You're trying to exert power that you shouldn't have over other people and not trusting the power and sovereignty of God. So witchcraft is definitely a very... It's a deep and serious issue and something that we should be on guard against and something you should be watching out for around us in its most sort of, so even its most socially acceptable forms of Ouija boards or whatever else, these kinds of things, at their root there is an idolatry there. It's a lack of trust in God. Then it goes on to talk about invocation of saints or of other creatures. And Roman Catholics in their official doctrine will tell you that they're not worshiping saints, that they're not, you know, it's veneration and it's, you know, you're asking them to pray for you, you're not praying to them, and but functionally, when you see the way that it works, think about these categories of having a God that we've, or these aspects of having a God that we've been talking about, expecting good from someone, love and fear and devotion to these things, and trusting in them, right? And you think about, what is it, there's a figurine of the saint that you bury in your property so that it'll sell more quickly. Saw a lot of that in the Boston area growing up. You have this, you know, patron saint of, name your thing, right? And you pray to that saint before you go on a journey. You pray to this saint before this or that. And you are putting your trust in something, even though they would say they're worshiping Jesus, they're worshiping the true living God, they're adding these other powers, these other people to whom they are they're praying and they're seeking good from them. And we're not given any example of that in Scripture. And it really is a syncretistic way of including all the old ideas of having multiple gods in the religion of in Christianity. Robert?
I had a friend that was his thinking. He was serious about it.
Right. I mean, it's almost funny, but it's not, right? I mean, it's pretty terrifying or horrifying that you'd. There is that idea that God in Catholicism is so unapproachable in a way that you go through Mary because Mary is approachable. And that love and devotion, when you think about love and devotion to someone in worship, the Mary cult, the worship of Mary is so deep and so personal and emotional that there's this, it's so clearly what we're talking about here in this answer, this trust, this seeking good from this love and devotion. So it's something we do need to still be aware of. It was really critical at this time because they were just coming out of Catholicism, but it's still something that you see people enslaved to today. And we need to be watching out for that. And then really at the very end of this answer, you have a summary of what it's been saying here, or what it means to keep this commandment. It says to renounce all creatures, then to do the least thing against his will. To renounce any creature or that would motivate you, any devotion to a creature, a person, a natural force, anything in this world that your devotion to that person or thing would make you break God's law. That's the heart of idolatry. And that gets into then this next question, question 95, that says, what is idolatry? Answer, idolatry is to conceive or have something else in which to place our trust instead of or besides the one true God who has revealed himself in his word. Idolatry is to conceive or have something else in which to place our trust instead of or besides the one true God who has revealed himself in his word. So that's what we've been talking about. I mean, it's a summary, again, of what we've been covering already so far. But I wanted to take a little bit of time here to think about scripturally, what are some of the things that aren't idols, literally, that aren't carved images of a god that we're warned against worshiping? What are some of the other forms of idolatry that we're warned against in Scripture? Things that people worshipped that weren't technically a god or explicitly a god. And you can look down through the references that are listed there, and you'll see a few examples. But what are some of the other things that we might be guilty of worshiping? Bill?
Well, some people carry their banners.
Okay. Yep. Some people carry a rabbit's foot. So that's a good example of trust. Right? The point is they're trusting in it, right? They're expecting good from it. And so it goes along with the horseshoe or the four-leaf clover or any of those other knocking on wood. I mean, how many of us do that? You know, it's sort of this idea that we're expecting some good from this other thing that's not God. It's this system of luck. What else does Scripture say that we worship or that some people worship wrongly? Money and possessions. Yeah, so there's a great verse for that in Matthew 6:24 in your book. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon being a word for money and possessions there. So, I mean, how often do we see that going on around us? If you think about what people love and are devoted to, you think about what people trust in, especially, I think this is especially true in our insurance culture. We have insurance for everything. And insurance becomes what we trust in, all right? You trust, we'll be okay, we'll be okay. We have this life insurance, we'll be okay. We have this health insurance, we'll be okay. Because that's our safety net. And it is wise maybe to have some of these insurance policies, but are you trusting in that? Is that what's really the source of good for you? And what are some of the other things the Bible talks about us worshiping?
About astrology.
Okay? So again, there's sort of a system of luck or some sort of generic spiritual power out there, right? That because it's the wrong day for your for your astrological sign, then you shouldn't do this or that, right? You see there at the top of the page, Philippians 3:19 on page 95. It's how it talks about whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly. The God of pleasure, the God of satisfaction, the God of food. As a person who loves food, and this is a temptation that we make food what we turn to for satisfaction, or that we glorify, or that we want to, that we make the pinnacle of our day, right? And that can be true of any pleasure. Scripture talks about covetousness as idolatry, coveting what you don't have. Something else becomes more important to you than keeping God's law, and then that works itself out in theft and deception and all kinds of other related sins where you try to get what you don't have when you don't deserve it because that thing has become your God. But just think about all the other things that people trust in, maybe trusting in the government. So often it's, we'll be okay because the government will take care of us, right? You know, we've got the safety net in place. Or you hear so much talk these days about karma or even a vague sense of justice. I've heard a lot of, especially just in the last couple of years, a lot of talk about the universe. The universe will, you know, it'll be okay. The universe will make it right. Or the universe will catch up with you. As if the universe has some system of justice that what goes around comes around. But people trust in that in a sense. They say, well, if I'm a good enough person, the universe will be good to me. But that is a form of idolatry. There are other things that are so easy to idolize, you know, acceptance and approval, popularity, fame, having a good reputation. So often we can idolize people. Think about, you know, if this person, you think about someone in your life, and you say, well, if this person's there, I'll be okay. If this person will be there for me. This person is my sense of security. But what if God takes that person away? And where will you be at that point? And so I would encourage you to test yourself for idolatry. I would sort of encourage you to ask yourself two questions or examine your life with these two questions. The first is, what am I willing to sin to have or keep in my life? What am I willing to sin to have or keep in my life? For what am I willing to sin? That was not a well-constructed sentence. For what am I willing to sin to have or keep it in my life? What things make you so angry that you become violent, or that you are you hurt other people, or you lie, or you steal, or what things motivate you that much? And if you are breaking God's law because you are so devoted to something, that is an idol in your life. And then the second question is, what can't I imagine going without in my life? What can't I imagine going without in my life? You know, what if that's gone? What if that person is gone? What if my nest egg is gone? What if my this particular pleasure that I enjoy in life is gone? What if this relationship is gone? And if we enjoy those good things, they may be good gifts from God, but ask yourself, is this such so dear to me that it's become a god in my life? And that if you're like Job and everything is taken, would you still be able to say, blessed be the name of the Lord? You know, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So test yourself, and I've had to test myself this week and will continue to. What are those things in your life that are idols? So I hope you've seen, as we think about this idol worship in a broader sense, not that sort of more literal specific sense, that you realize just how much idolatry is going on around us all the time. That love and devotion to things that aren't God as the most important thing in your life, seeking security and other things. Even if we don't have temples and shrines on every street corner, we have temples and shrines of other kinds that show where our devotion is and where our money goes and where our thoughts go all the time. Just because I or you haven't literally bowed down to a carved image and, you know, burned an offering or given money in an idol's money box, we are all guilty of idolatry in so many different ways. And with all of these laws, as we go through the Ten Commandments, that the first purpose of the law is to drive us back to Christ and to say, have mercy on me, a sinner, God. And then to say, now, Lord, please help me to live this and to honor you with my life. Any questions today? Jim? Say it again. Obesity. I think obesity can be a symptom of idolatry. If you are not caring for your own body because of your devotion to food or lack of exercise. But there are all kinds of things that impact obesity. There are genetic factors and all kinds of things like that too. But it can be a sign of idolatry. Any other questions? All right, well, let's sing our closing psalm then. Actually, before I get to that, I forgot. I have an article, a really brief article that my dad just sent me yesterday. Someone had sent it to him because it was written by my grandfather, my mom's dad, when he was a missionary in Japan back in the early 60s. And it's called Enslaved in Idolatry. And he's describing two aspects of Japanese culture that he'd observed at that point, and that were both forms of idolatry. One of them was explicit shrine worship, and the other was the idolatry of money. And so it's an interesting little article. It's just a front and back, not even a full page on the back. This is taken out of the Covenanter Witness from 1961, I think. So if you have time, give that a read. But Julia and Quentin, could I have you hand those out?